I remembered my dream, the harsh voice of the giantess who had swatted my pickle jar off the bar. "Heimdall," I asked, "can you see Thrym? What's he up to?" The god squinted and looked deeper into the void. "Yes, there he is, just at the edge of my vision, under a mile or so of rock. Sitting in that horrid fortress of his. Why he wants to live in a cave decorated like a bar, I have no idea. Oh, he is so ugly! I pity the person who marries him." "Great," Sam muttered. "What's he doing?" "Drinking," Heimdall said. "Now he's belching. Now he's drinking again. His sister, Thringa, oh, her voice is like ore scraping on ice. She's berating him for being a fool. Something about his wedding being a stupid idea and they should just kill the bride as soon as she arrives." Heimdall paused, maybe remembering that Samir was the poor girl in question. Sorry. As I thought, though, there's no hammer anywhere. That's not surprising. These earth giants, they can bury things...
"Let me guess," I said. "In the earth?"
"Exactly!" Heimdall looked impressed with my knowledge of earth giants. "They can retrieve those items simply by calling them back to hand. I imagine Thrym will wait until the wedding is finished. Once he has his bride and his bride price, he'll summon the hammer. If he feels like keeping his part of the bargain, that is."
Amir looked more nauseated than I'd felt aboard the Cessna Citation.
"Sam, you can't do this. It's too dangerous." "I won't," she balled her fists. "Lord Heimdall, you're the guardian of the sacred marriage bed, aren't you? The old stories say you traveled among humankind advising couples, blessing their offspring, and creating the various classes of Viking society."
"I did?"
Heimdall glanced at his phone as if tempted to look up this information. Yes, of course." "Then hear my sacred vow," Sam said. "I swear upon the Bifrost and all the Nine Worlds that I will never marry anyone except this man, Amir Fadlan."
Thankfully, she pointed in the correct direction and did not implicate me. Otherwise, things might have been awkward.
"I will not even pretend to marry this giant, Thrym. It will not happen."
Alex Fierro rose, his mouth set in a frown.
Sam?
I figured Alex was thinking the same thing I was, that if Loki could control Sam's actions, she might not be able to keep this vow. Sam gave Alex a warning look. Surprisingly, Alex shut up.
"I have made my vow," Sam announced. "Inshallah, I will keep it and marry Amir Fadlan in accordance with the teachings of the Quran and the Prophet Muhammad. Peace be upon him."
I wondered if the Bifrost Bridge would collapse under the heavy-duty Muslim sacred vow Sam was laying down, but nothing seemed different except for Amir, who looked like he'd been hit between the eyes with a phablet.
"Peace be upon him," he stammered.
Heimdall sniffled.
"That was so sweet."
A tear as white as plant sap slid down his cheek.
"I hope you crazy kids make a go of it. I really do. I wish..."
He tilted his head, listening to the distant murmurings of the universe.
"Nope. I'm not on the guest list for your wedding with Thrym. Darn it."
Sam looked at me like, did I just imagine the last few minutes?
"Lord Heimdall, you mean the wedding I just swore not to go through with?"
"Yes," he confirmed. "I'm sure it will be lovely. But that soon-to-be sister-in-law of yours, Thringa, is going on and on." "No way, sir. No veneer. They apparently have some first-rate security in place for screening the guests."
"They don't want Thor getting in," Alex guessed, "and stealing back his hammer."
"That would make sense." Heimdall kept his eyes on the horizon. "The thing is, this underground fortress bar of theirs, I've seen how it works. There's only one way in, and the entrance tunnel keeps shifting around, opening in a different place every day. Sometimes it turns up behind a waterfall, or in a Midgard cave, or under the roots of a tree. Even if Thor wanted to plan an assault, he'd have no idea where to start on any given day. I don't see how you could arrange an ambush to steal the hammer." He frowned. "Thrym and Thringa are still talking about the guest list. Only family and giants are invited, and who is Randolph?"
I felt as if somebody had turned up the thermostat on the Bifrost. My face itched like a hand-shaped burn mark was forming across my cheek. "Randolph is my uncle," I said. "Can you see him?" Heimdall shook his head.
"Not in Jotunheim. But Thrym and Thringa are very annoyed about him being on the list. Thrym is saying, Loki insists. Thringa is throwing bottles."
Heimdall winced.
"Sorry, I had to look away. Without the camera, everything seems so 3D. Amir watched me with concern.
Magnus, you have an uncle who's involved in all this?
I didn't want to get into it. The scene from the zombie's barrow kept replaying in my mind. Randolph crying as he drove the Skofnung sword into Blitzen's gut. Thankfully, Alex Fierro changed the subject.
Hey, Lord Selfie, he said. What about the goat killer? That's who we need to find right now.
Ah, yes.
Heimdall raised his sword blade over his eyes like a visor, nearly decapitating me in the process.
You said a figure in black clothes with a metal helmet and a faceplate like a snarling wolf?
That's him, I said.
I don't see him, but there is something strange. I know I said no camera, but... Ah, I'm not sure how to describe this.
He raised his phablet and snapped a picture.
What do you make of this?
The four of us gathered around the screen. It was hard to judge the scale since the shot had been taken from interdimensional space, but at the top of a cliff sat a massive warehouse-looking building. Across the roof stretched glittery neon letters almost as eye-catching as the Sitgo sign, Utgard Lanes. Behind that, even larger and more awe-inspiring, was an inflatable Godzilla, like you might see advertising a sale at a car dealership. In Godzilla's hands was a cardboard sign that read, "Sup, Magnus. Come visit. Got info for you. Bring your friends. Only way to beat Thrym plus good bowling. XOX Big Boy." I let out a few Norse cuss words. I was tempted to throw the Phablet of Doomsday off the Bifrost Bridge. "Big boy," I said. "I should have known."
"This is bad," Sam muttered.
"He told you that someday you would need his help."
"But if he's our only hope, we're doomed."
"Why?" Amir asked. "Yeah," Alex demanded. "Who is this big boy who communicates through inflatable Godzillas?"
"I know this one," Heimdall said cheerfully. "He's the most dangerous, powerful giant sorcerer of all time. His real name is Utgard Loki."
Chapter 33. Falafel break? "Yes, thank you." Another Viking pro tip. If Heimdall offers to drop you somewhere, say no. Heimdall's idea of sending us back to Midgard was making the Bifrost dissolve around our feet and literally dropping us through infinity. Once we stopped screaming, or it may have been just me again, don't judge, we found ourselves at the corner of Charles and Boylston, standing in front of the Edgar Allan Poe statue. By that point, I definitely had a telltale heart. My pulse was going so fast you could have heard that sucker through a brick wall. We were all exhausted, but we were also hungry and buzzing with post-rainbow adrenaline. Most importantly, we were a block from the transportation building food court, where the Fodlons had a restaurant. "You know," Amir flexed his fingers as if making sure they were still there, "I could make us some dinner." "You don't have to, man," I said, which I thought was pretty noble considering how much I loved his family's falafel recipe. I know he asked me to remind him not to give me any more falafel, but I had decided to interpret that request as temporary insanity. Amir shook his head. "No, I want to." I understood what he meant. The guy's world had just been cracked open. He needed to do something familiar to steady his nerves. He craved the comfort of deep-frying chickpea patties, and really, who was I to argue? The transportation building was closed for the night, but Amir had the keys. He let us in, opened Fodlan's falafel, and prepped the kitchen to make us a late dinner slash really early breakfast of amazingness. Meanwhile, Alex, Sam, and I sat at a table in the darkened food court, listening to the clanging of pots and fire cages echo through the vast space like metallic bird cries. Sam looked dazed. She tipped over a salt shaker and wrote letters in the white grains. Whether Norse or Arabic, I couldn't tell. Alex kicked up his rose high tops on the opposite chair. He twiddled his thumbs, his two-toned eyes scanning the room. "So, this sorcerer giant..." "Utgard Loki," I said. A lot of folks in the Norse cosmos had warned me that names had power. You weren't supposed to utter them unless you had to. Me, I preferred to wear names out like hand-me-down clothes. That seemed the best way to drain the power from them. "He's not my favorite giant." I glanced around the floor, making sure there were no talking pigeons nearby. "A few months ago, he showed up right here, tricked me into giving him my falafel. Then he turned into an eagle and dragged me across the rooftops of Boston." Alex drummed his fingers on the table. "And now he wants you to come visit his bowling alley." "You know the really messed up part? That's the least crazy thing that has happened to me this week." Alex snorted. "So why is he called Loki?" He looked at Sam. "Any relation to us?" Sam shook her head.
"His name means Loki of the Outlands. No connection to our dad." Not since the great alderman disaster of that afternoon had the word dad invoked such negative feelings in a conversation. Looking at Alex and Sam sitting across from each other, I couldn't imagine two people more different. Yet they both wore exactly the same expression, sour resignation that they shared the god of trickery as their pop. On the bright side, I said, Utgard Loki didn't strike me as a big fan of the other Loki. I can't see the two of them working together. They're both giants, Alex pointed out. Giants fight among each other just like humans, Sam said, and, judging by what we learned from Heimdall, getting the hammer back from Thrym will not be easy. We need all the advice we can get. Utgard Loki is crafty. He might be the right person to figure out a way to foil Dad's plans.
Fight Loki with Loki, I said.
Alex ran his hand through his shock of green hair. I don't care how tricky and clever your giant friend is. In the end, we're going to have to go to that wedding and get the hammer. Which means we'll have to face Loki ourselves.
We? I asked.
I'm going with you, Alex said. Obviously. I remembered my dream of Loki in Alex's apartment. It's such a simple request. Having two children of Loki at the wedding, both of whom could be controlled by Loki's slightest whim, that was not my definition of a joyous occasion.
Samira drew another design in the salt.
Alex, I can't ask you to go.
You're not asking, Alex said. I'm telling. You brought me into the afterlife. This is my chance to make it count.
You know what we need to do.
Sam shook her head.
I still don't think that's a good idea.
Alex threw his hands in the air.
Are you even related to me? Where's your sense of recklessness? Of course it's not a good idea, but it's the only way.
What idea? I asked. What way?
Clearly I had missed the conversation between the two of them, but neither looked anxious to fill me in. Just then, Amir came back with the food. He set down a heaping platter of lamb kebab, dolma, falafel, kibbeh, and other heavenly yummies, and I remembered my priorities.
You, sir, I said, are a powerful entity.
He almost smiled. He started to sit next to Sam, but Alex snapped his fingers.
Uh-uh, lover boy. Chaperone says no.
Amir looked mortified. He moved to sit between Alex and me.
We dug in.
Actually, I may have done most of the digging in. Amir bit off the corner of a pita bread triangle.
It doesn't seem possible. Food tastes the same. The fryer fries at the same temperature. My keys work in the same locks, and yet the whole universe has changed.
Not everything has changed, Sam promised. Amir's expression was wistful, as if remembering a good experience from childhood that couldn't be recaptured.
I appreciate it, Sam, he said, and I do see what you mean about the Norse deities. They aren't gods. Anyone who could take so many selfies with a sword and a ram's horn.
He shook his head. Allah may have 99 names, but Heimdall isn't one of them.
Alex grinned. I like this guy.
Amir blinked, apparently unsure what to do with the compliment.
So, what now? How do you top a trip across the Bifrost?
Sam gave him a faint smile. Well, tonight, I have to have a conversation with Jeed and Bibi to explain why I've been out so late.
Amir nodded.
Will you try to show them the Nine Worlds as you did for me?
She can't, Alex said. They're too old. Their brains aren't as flexible.
Hey, I said. No need to be rude.
Just being honest, Alex chewed on a piece of lamb.
The older you are, the harder it is to accept that the world might not be the way you thought it was. It's a miracle that Amir managed to see through all the mist and the glamour without going insane.
He kept his eyes on me a moment longer than seemed necessary.
Yes, Amir muttered. I feel very fortunate not to be insane.
Alex is right, though, Sam said. When I talked to my grandparents this morning, the conversation they'd had with Loki was already fading from their memory. They knew they were supposed to be angry at me. They remembered that you and I had been arguing, but the details...
She made a poof gesture with her fingertips.
Amir rubbed his chin. My dad was the same. He only asked if you and I had patched up our differences. I suspect...
We could tell them anything about where we were tonight, couldn't we?
Any mundane excuse, and they would believe it more readily than the truth.
Alex elbowed him. Don't get any ideas, lover boy. I'm still your chaperone.
No, I only meant... I would never...
Relax, Alex said. I'm messing with you.
Ah, Amir did not seem to relax.
And after tonight? What then?
We go to Jotunheim, Sam said. We have a giant to interrogate.
You're traveling to another world? Amir shook his head in amazement.
You know, when I arranged those flying lessons with Barry,
I thought I was expanding your horizons.
He laughed mirthlessly. Foolish of me.
Amir, that was the kindest gift. It's all right. I'm not complaining, I just...
He let out a sharp exhale.
What can I do to help you?
Sam put her hand flat on the table, her fingers stretched toward Amir like an air version of holding hands.
Just trust me. Believe what I promised.
I do, he said. But there must be something else. Now that I can see everything, he waved a plastic fork at the ceiling. I want to support you.
You are, Sam assured him. You've seen me as a Valkyrie, and you haven't run away screaming.
You don't know how much that helps. Just stay safe for me, please, until we get back. Be my anchor.
Happily, although, he gave her a grin so sheepish it smelled like Heimdall.
I haven't actually seen you as a Valkyrie. Do you think?
Sam got to her feet. Alex, Agnes, I'll meet you in the morning.
The statue in the park, I said. See you there.
She nodded. Amir, 2 days hence, this will all be over, I promise.
She rose into the air and disappeared in a golden flash. The plastic fork fell out of Amir's hand.
It's true, he said. I can't believe it.
Alex grinned. Well, it's getting late. There is one more thing you can do for us, Amir, buddy.
Of course, anything.
How about a doggy bag for this falafel?
Chapter 34. We visit my favorite mausoleum. The next morning, I woke in my own bed in Valhalla, unrefreshed and definitely not ready to go. I packed a duffel with camping supplies and leftover falafel. I checked in across the hall with TJ, who handed me the Skofnung sword and promised to remain on standby in case I needed cavalry reinforcements or help charging enemy fortifications. Then I met up with Alex Fierro in the lobby and we headed out to Midgard. Alex agreed to make one stop with me before he rendezvoused with the others. I didn't really want to, but I felt obliged to break into Randolph's Back Bay mansion and check in on my murderous, traitorous uncle. Because, you know, that's what family is for. I wasn't sure what I would do if I found him. Maybe I'd figure out a way to free him from Loki's clutches. Maybe I'd smack him in the face with a bag of kibbe. Though that would be a waste of good kibbe. Fortunately for Randolph and my leftovers, he wasn't home. I jimmied the back door as usual. Randolph had not gotten the message about upgrading his locks. Then Alex and I wandered through the mansion, stealing Randolph's various stashes of chocolate, because that was a necessity, making fun of his fussy draperies and knickknacks, and finally ending up in the old man's office. Nothing there had changed since my last visit. Maps lay on the desk. The big Viking tombstone thing stood in the corner, its figure of a wolf still snarling at me. Medieval weapons and trinkets lined the shelves, along with leather-bound books and photographs of Randolph at dig sites in Scandinavia. On the chain around my neck, Jack's pendant buzzed with tension. I had never brought him to Randolph's house before. I guess he didn't like the place. Or maybe he was just excited because the Skofnung sword was strapped across my back. I turned to Alex. Hey, are you female today? The question slipped out before I had a chance to think about whether it was weird, whether it was rude, or whether it would get me decapitated. Alex smiled with what I hoped was amusement and not homicidal glee. Why do you ask? The Skofnung sword. It can't be drawn in the presence of women. I kind of like it better when it can't be drawn. Ah, hold on. Alex's face scrunched up in intense concentration. There. Now I'm female. My expression must have been priceless. Alex burst out laughing. I'm kidding. Yes, I'm female today. She and her. But you didn't just... change gender by force of will? No, Magnus, it doesn't work that way. She ran her fingers across Randolph's desk. The stained glass transom window cast multicolored light across her face. So can I ask? I waved my hands vaguely. I didn't have the words. How it does work? She smirked. As long as you don't ask me to represent every gender-fluid person for you, okay? I'm not an ambassador. I'm not a teacher or a poster child. I'm just... She mimicked my hand-waving. Me. Trying to be me as best I can. That sounded fair. At least it was better than her punching me, garroting me, or turning into a cheetah and mauling me. But you're a shapeshifter, I said. Can't you just, you know, be whatever you want? Her darker eye twitched, as if I'd poked a sore spot. That's the irony. She picked up a letter opener and turned it in the stained glass light. I can look like whatever or whoever I want. But my actual gender? No. I can't change it at will. It's truly fluid in the sense that I don't control it. Most of the time, I identify as female, but sometimes I have very male days. And please don't ask me how I know which I am on which day. That had, in fact, been my next question. So why not call yourself, like, they and them? Wouldn't that be less confusing than switching back and forth with the pronouns? Less confusing for who? You? My mouth must have been hanging open because she rolled her eyes at me like, you dork. I hoped Heimdall wasn't recording the conversation to put on Vine. Look, some people prefer they, Alex said. They're non-binary or mid-spectrum or whatever. If they want you to use they, then that's what you should do. But for me, personally, I don't want to use the same pronouns all the time, because that's not me. I change a lot. That's sort of the point. When I'm she, I'm she. When I'm he, I'm he. I'm not they. Get it? If I say no, will you hurt me? No. Then no, not really. She shrugged. You don't have to get it, just, you know, a little respect. For the girl with the very sharp wire, no problem. She must have liked that answer. There was nothing confusing about the smile she gave me. It warmed the office about 5 degrees. I cleared my throat. Anyway, we're looking for anything that might tell us what's going on with my uncle. I started checking the bookshelves as if I had a clue about what I was doing. I didn't find any secret messages or levers that opened hidden rooms. It always looked so easy on Scooby-Doo. Alex rummaged through Randolph's desk drawers. So you used to live in this big mausoleum? Thankfully, no. My mom and I had an apartment in Alston before she died. Then I was on the streets. But your family had money. Randolph did. I picked up an old photo of him with Caroline, Aubrey, and Emma. It was too painful to look at. I turned it around. You're going to ask why I didn't come to live with him instead of being homeless? Alex scoffed. Gods no, I would never ask that. Her voice had turned bitter, as if rich jerk relatives were something she knew about. You come from somewhere like this? I asked. Alex closed the desk drawer. My family had a lot of things, just not the things that mattered. Like a son and heir, for instance. Or, you know, feelings. I tried to imagine Alex living in a mansion like this, or mingling at an elegant party like Mr. Alderman's in Alfheim. Did your folks know you were a child of Loki? Oh, Loki made sure of that. My mortal parents blamed him for the way I was, for being fluid. They said he corrupted me, put ideas in my head, blah blah blah. And your parents didn't just conveniently forget Loki, like Sam's grandparents did? I wish. Loki made sure they remembered. He opened their eyes permanently, I guess you could say. Like what you did for Amir, except my dad's motives weren't as good. I didn't do anything for Amir. Alex walked over to me and crossed her arms. She was wearing pink and green flannel today over regular blue jeans. Her hiking boots were boringly practical, except the laces glittered pink metallic. Her different colored eyes seemed to pull my thoughts in 2 directions at once. You really believe you didn't do anything? She asked. When you grabbed Amir's shoulders? When your hands started to glow? I glowed? I didn't have any recollection of calling on the power of Frey. It hadn't even occurred to me that Amir needed healing. You saved him, Magnus, Alex said. Even I could see that. He would have cracked under the strain. You gave him the resilience to stretch his mind without breaking. The only reason he's in one piece, mentally, is because of you. I felt like I was back on the Bifrost Bridge, superheated colors burning through me. I didn't know what to do with the look of approval Alex was giving me, or the idea that I might have healed Amir's mind without even knowing it. She punched me in the chest, just hard enough to hurt. How about we finish up? I'm starting to suffocate in this place. Yeah, sure. I was having trouble breathing, too, but it wasn't because of the house. The way Alex spoke so approvingly of me, that had made something click. I realized who she reminded me of. Her restless energy, her petite size and choppy haircut, her flannel shirt and jeans and boots, her disregard for what other people thought of her, even her laugh. On those rare occasions she laughed. She reminded me weirdly of my mom. I decided not to dwell on that. Pretty soon I'd be psychoanalyzing myself more than Otis the goat. I scanned the shelves one last time, my eyes fixed on the only framed photo without Randolph in it. A shot of a frozen waterfall in the wilderness, sheets of ice hanging over the ledges of a gray cliff. It could have been just a pretty nature picture from anywhere, but it looked familiar. The colors in it were more vibrant than in the other photos, as if this shot had been taken more recently. I picked it up. There was no dust on the shelf where the frame had been, but there was something else. A green wedding invitation. Alex studied the photo. I know that place. Bridal Veil Falls, I said. New Hampshire. I've gone hiking there.
Same.
Under different circumstances, we might have traded hiking stories. It was another weird similarity between her and my mom, and maybe the reason why Alex had an open atrium in the middle of her hotel suite just like mine. But at the moment, my mind was racing in a different direction. I remembered what Heimdall had said about the Fortress of Thrym, how its entrance was always changing, so it would be impossible to predict where it might be on the day of the wedding.
Sometimes it turns up behind a waterfall, he'd said.
I scanned the wedding invitation, an exact duplicate of the one Sam had thrown away. The when column now said, 2 days hence. In other words, the day after tomorrow. The where column still said, we'll get back to you. The picture of Bridal Veil Falls might just be a random photo. The name of the location might be a coincidence. Or maybe Uncle Randolph wasn't completely under Loki's control. Maybe he'd left me a clue worthy of Scooby-Doo.
That's Sam's wedding invitation, Alex said. You think it means something that it was tucked behind this photo?
Could be nothing, I said. Or it could be a point of entry for some wedding crashers. Chapter 35. We have a tiny problem. Rendezvous spot. The George Washington statue in the public garden. Hearthstone, Blitzen, and Samir were already there, along with another old friend who happened to be an eight-legged horse.
Stanley, I said.
The stallion whinnied and nuzzled me. He nodded toward the statue of George Washington on his charger as if to say, Can you believe this dude? He ain't so great. His horse only has 4 legs. The first time I had met Stanley, we'd hurtled off a Jotunheim cliff together, heading for a giant's fortress. I was glad to see the horse again, but I had a bad feeling we were about to take part in the sequel, Cliff Hurtling 2, The Rise of Big Boy. I stroked Stanley's muzzle, wishing I had a carrot for him. All I had was chocolate and kibbe, and I didn't think either would be good for an 8-legged horse.
Did you summon him? I asked Hearthstone. How are you still conscious?
The first time Hearth used AWAS, the transportation runestone, he'd collapsed and giggled about washing machines for half an hour. Hearth shrugged, though I detected a little pride in his expression. He looked better today after spending a night in the tanning bed. His black jeans and jacket were freshly cleaned, and he had his familiar candy-striped scarf around his neck. Easier now, he signed. I can do 2, maybe 3 runes in a row before I collapse.
Wow.
What did he say? Alex asked. I translated.
Just 2 or 3? Alex asked.
I mean, no offense, but that doesn't sound like a lot.
It is, I said. Using 1 rune is like the hardest workout you've ever done. Imagine an hour of non-stop sprinting.
Yeah, I don't really work out, so...
Blitzen cleared his throat. Magnus? Who's your friend?
Sorry, this is Alex Fierro.
Blitzen? Hearthstone?
Alex is our newest inheritee.
Blitzen was wearing his pith helmet, so it was difficult to see his expression through the gauze netting. However, I was pretty sure he wasn't grinning in delight.
You're the other child of Loki, he said.
Yep, Alex said. I promise I won't kill you.
For Alex, that was a pretty big concession, but Hearth and Blitz didn't seem to know what to make of her. Samir gave me a dry smile.
What? I demanded.
Nothing.
She was wearing her school uniform, which I thought was pretty optimistic, like...
I'll just zip over to Jotunheim and be back in time for third period government.
Where have you two been? You didn't come from the direction of Valhalla. I explained about our excursion to Randolph's and the photo and wedding invitation that were now in my backpack. Sam frowned.
You think this waterfall is the way into Thrym's fortress?
Maybe, I said. Or at least it might be 2 days from now. If we know that in advance, we might be able to use the info.
How? Hearth signed.
I'm not sure yet.
Blitzen grunted. I suppose it's possible. Earth giants can manipulate solid rock even better than dwarves can. They can definitely shift their front doors around. Also, he shook his head in disgust, their fortresses are almost impossible to break into. Tunneling, explosives, blasts of godly power, none of that will work. Believe me, D.I.C.E. has tried.
Dice? I asked.
He looked at me like I was a moron. The Dwarven Infantry Corps of Engineers. What else would it stand for? Anyway, with Earth Giants, you have to use the main entrance. But even if your uncle knew where it would be on the wedding day, why would he share that information? This is the man who stabbed me in the gut.
I didn't need the reminder. I saw that scene every time I closed my eyes. I also didn't have a good answer for him, but Alex intervened.
Shouldn't we get going?
Sam nodded. You're right. Stanley will only stay summoned for a few minutes. He prefers no more than 3 passengers, so I figured I would fly and carry Hearthstone. Magnus, how about you, Alex, and Blitz take our horse friend?
Blitzen shifted uneasily in his navy 3-piece suit. Maybe he was thinking how badly he and Alex would clash sitting next to each other on the horse.
It's okay, Hearthstone signed to him. Be safe.
All right. Blitz glanced at me. But I've got dibs on the front. Is that called shotgun on a horse?
Stanley whinnied and stomped. I don't think he liked shotgun and horse being used in the same sentence.
I handed Sam the Skofnung sword. Blitzen gave her the Skofnung stone. We figured, since they were her supposed bride price, she should have the right to carry them. She wouldn't be able to draw the sword because of its enchantments, but at least she could brain people with the stone if the need arose.
Stanley allowed us to climb aboard. Blitzen first, Alex in the middle, and me in the back. Or as I like to think of it, the seat from which you will fall off and die in case of rapid ascent. I was afraid that if I held on to Alex, she might cut off my head or turn into a giant lizard and bite me or something. But she grabbed my wrists and put them around her waist. I'm not fragile, and I'm not contagious.
I didn't say anything.
Shut up.
Shutting up.
She smelled of clay, like the pottery studio in her suite. She also had a tiny tattoo I hadn't noticed before on the nape of her neck. The curled double serpents of Loki. When I realized what I was looking at, my stomach took a preemptive drop off a cliff, but I didn't have much time to process the tattoo's significance.
Sam said, "See you in Jotunheim."
She grabbed Hearthstone's arm and the two of them vanished in a flash of golden light. Stanley wasn't quite so understated. He galloped toward Arlington Street, jumped the park fence, and charged straight toward the Taj Hotel. A moment before we would have hit the wall, Stanley went airborne. The hotel's marble facade dissolved into a bank of fog, and Stanley did a 360 barrel roll right through it, somehow managing not to lose us. His hooves touched the ground again, and we were charging through a forested ravine, mountains looming on either side. Snow-covered pines towered above us. Gunmetal gray clouds hung low and heavy. My breath turned to steam. I had time to think, hey, we're in Jotunheim, before Blitzen yelled, "Duck!" The next millisecond demonstrated how much faster I could think than react. First, I thought Blitz had spotted an actual duck. Blitzen likes ducks. Then I realized he was telling me to get down, which is hard to do when you're the last in line of 3 people on horseback. Then I saw the large tree branch hanging directly in our path. I realized Stanley was going to run right under it at full speed. Even if the branch had been properly labeled low clearance, Stanley couldn't read. Smack! I found myself flat on my back in the snow. Above me, pine branches swayed in fuzzy technicolor. My teeth ached. I managed to sit up. My vision cleared and I spotted Alex a few feet away, curled up and groaning in a pile of pine needles. Blitzen staggered around looking for his pith helmet. Fortunately, Jotunheim light wasn't strong enough to petrify doors or he would have already turned to stone. As for our intrepid ride, Stanley, he was gone. A trail of hoofprints continued under the tree branch and into the woods as far as I could see. Maybe he'd reached the end of his summoning time and vanished. Or maybe he'd gotten caught up in the joy of running and wouldn't realize he'd left us behind for another 20 miles. Blitzen snatched his pith helmet out of the snow.
Stupid horse, that was rude.
I helped Alex to her feet. A nasty-looking cut zigzagged across her forehead like a squiggly red mouth.
You're bleeding, I said. I can fix that.
She swatted away my hand. I'm fine, Dr. House, but thanks for the diagnosis. She turned unsteadily, scanning the forest.
Where are we?
More importantly, Blitz said, where are the others? Sam and Hearthstone were nowhere to be seen. I only hoped Sam was better at avoiding obstacles than Stanley was. I scowled at the tree branch we'd run into. I wondered if I could get Jack to chop it down before the next group of poor schmucks rode through here. But there was something strange about its texture. Instead of the usual bark pattern, it consisted of cross-hatched gray fiber. It didn't taper to a point, but instead curved down to the ground, where it snaked across the snow. Not a branch, then. More like a huge cable.
The top of the cable wound into the trees and disappeared into the clouds.
"What is this thing?" I asked. "It's not a tree."
To our left, a dark looming shape I'd taken for a mountain shifted and rumbled. I realized, with bladder-twisting certainty, that it wasn't a mountain. The largest giant I'd ever seen was sitting next to us.
"No, indeed," his voice boomed. "That's my shoestring!"
How could I not notice a giant that big? Well, if he didn't know what you were looking at, he was simply too large to understand. His hiking boots were foothills. His bent knees were mountain peaks. His dark gray bowling shirt blended in with the sky, and his fluffy white beard looked like a bank of snow clouds. Even sitting down, the giant's gleaming eyes were so far up they could have been blimps or moons.
"Hello, little ones."
The giant's voice was deep enough to liquefy soft substances, like my eyeballs, for instance.
"You should watch where you are going."
He tucked in his right foot. The tree branch, slash shoelace we'd smacked into, slithered through the pines, uprooting bushes, snapping branches, and scattering terrified woodland creatures. A 12-point buck leaped out of nowhere and almost ran over Blitzen. The giant leaned over, blocking out the gray light. He tied his shoe, humming as he worked, looping one massive cable over the other. The laces flailing and laying waste to whole swaths of forest. Once the giant had done a proper double knot, the earth stopped shaking. Alex yelled, "Who are you? And why haven't you ever heard of Velcro straps?" I'm not sure where she found the courage to speak. Maybe it was her hand injury talking. Me, I was trying to decide if Jack had the power to kill a giant this big. Even if Jack managed to fly up the giant's nose, I doubted his blade would do much more than cause a sneeze. And we didn't want that. The giant straightened and laughed. I wondered if his ears popped when he got that high in the stratosphere.
"Hoo-hoo! The green-haired gnat is feisty. My name is Tiny."
Now that I looked, I could see the name Tiny embroidered on his bowling shirt like the distant letters of the Hollywood sign. "Tiny," I said. I didn't think he could possibly hear me any more than I could hear ants having an argument, but he grinned and nodded.
"Yes, puny one. The other giants like to tease me because, compared to most at Utgard Loki's palace, I am small."
Blitzen dusted twigs from his blue jacket.
"It's gotta be an illusion," he muttered to us. "He can't really be that big."
Alex touched her bloody forehead. "This isn't an illusion. That shoelace felt plenty real." The giant stretched.
"Well, it's a good thing you woke me from my nap. I suppose I should get going."
"Hold on," I yelled. "You said you were from Utgard Loki's palace?"
"Hmm? Oh, yes. Utgard Lanes. Would you be heading that way?"
Yeah, I said. "We need to see the king." I was hoping Tiny might scoop us up and give us a ride. That seemed like the proper thing to do for travelers who just had a hit and run with your shoestring. Tiny chuckled.
"I don't know how you'd fare at Utgard Lanes. We're a little busy getting ready for the bowling tournament tomorrow. If you can't even navigate around our shoestrings, you might get accidentally crushed."
"We'll do fine," Alex said, again with a lot more confidence than I could have mustered. "Where is the palace?"
"Just over yonder."
Tiny waved to his left, causing a new low-pressure front.
"Easy 2-minute walk."
I tried to translate that from giant tees. I figured that meant the palace was about 7 billion miles away. "You couldn't give us a lift, maybe?" I tried not to sound too pitiful.
"Well, now," Tiny said, "I don't really owe you any favors, do I? You'd have to make it over the threshold of the fortress to claim guest privileges. Then, we'll have to treat you right."
"Here we go," Blitzen grumbled.
I remembered how guest rights worked from our last time in Jotunheim. If you made it inside the house and claimed you were a guest, supposedly the host couldn't kill you. Of course, when we tried that before, we ended up slaughtering an entire giant family after they attempted to squash us like bugs. But it all been done with the utmost courtesy.
"Besides," Tiny continued, "if you can't make it to Utgard Lanes yourself, you really shouldn't be there. Most giants are not as easygoing as I am. You need to be careful, little ones. My larger kin might take you for trespassers or termites or something. Really, I would stay away."
I had a terrible vision of Sam and Hearthstone flying into the bowling alley and getting caught in the world's largest bug zapper.
"We have to get there," I shouted. "We're meeting two friends."
"Hmm."
Tiny raised his forearm, revealing a Mount Rushmore-sized tattoo of Elvis Presley. The giant scratched his beard, and a single white whisker twirled down like an Apache helicopter and crashed nearby, sending up a mushroom cloud of snow.
"Tell you what, then. You carry my bowling bag. That way, everyone will know you're a friend. Do me this small service, and I'll vouch for you with Utgard Loki. Try to keep up. But if you do fall behind, make sure you reach the castle by tomorrow morning. That's when the tournament begins."
He got to his feet and turned to leave. I had time to admire his scraggly gray man bun and read the giant yellow words embroidered across the back of his shirt. Tiny's Turkey Bowlers. I wondered if that was the name of his team, or maybe his business. I pictured turkeys the size of cathedrals, and I knew they would be haunting my nightmares forever. Then, in two steps, Tiny disappeared over the horizon. I looked at my friends. What did we just get ourselves into?
"Well, good news," Blitzen said. "I found the bag."
"Bad news. I found the bag." He pointed to a nearby mountain, a sheer, dark cliff that rose 500 feet to a wide plateau at the summit. But of course, it wasn't a mountain. It was a brown leather bowling bag. Chapter 36. Solving Problems with Extreme Fashion. At this point, most people would have thrown themselves down on the ground and given up hope. And by most people, I mean me. I sat in the snow and stared up at the towering cliffs of Mount Bowling Bag. Tiny's Turkey Bowlers was etched across the brown leather in black letters so faded they looked like random fault lines. "There's no way," I said. Alex's forehead had stopped bleeding, but the skin around the cut had turned as green as her hair, which wasn't a good sign. "I hate to agree with you, Maggie, but yeah, it's impossible." "Please don't call me Maggie," I said. "Even Beantown is better than that." Alex looked like she was mentally filing away that information for later use. "What do you want to bet there's a bowling ball in that bag? Probably weighs as much as an aircraft carrier."
"Doesn't matter," I asked. "Even empty, the bag is too big to move."
Only Blitzen didn't look defeated. He paced around the foot of the bag, running his fingers across the leather, muttering to himself as if running calculations.
"It has to be an illusion," he said. "No bowling bag could be this big. No giant is that big."
"They are called giants," I noted. "Maybe if we had Hearthstone here, he could do some rune magic, but..."
"Kid, work with me," Blitz said. "I'm trying to problem solve. This is a fashion accessory. It's a bag. This is my specialty."
I wanted to argue that bowling bags were about as far from fashion as Boston was from China. I didn't see how one dwarf, no matter how talented, could solve this mountain of a problem with a few clever style choices. But I didn't want to seem negative.
"What are you thinking?" I asked.
"Well, we can't dispel the illusion outright," Blitz murmured.
"We have to work with what we have, not against it. I wonder..."
He put his ear to the leather as if listening. Then he began to grin.
Blitz," I said. "You make me nervous when you smile like that."
"This bag was never finished. It has no name."
"A name?" Alex said.
"Like, hi, bag. My name is Alex. What's yours?"
Blitzen nodded. "Exactly. Dwarves always name their creations. No item is fully crafted until it has a name."
"Yeah, but Blitz," I said. "This is a giant's bag, not a dwarf's bag."
"Ah, but it could be. Don't you see? I could finish crafting it."
Alex and I both stared at him. He sighed.
"Look, while I was hanging out with Hearthstone in the safe house, I got bored. I started thinking up new projects. One of them, well, you know Hearthstone's personal rune, right? Perthrow?"
"The empty cup," I said.
"Yeah, I remember."
"The what?" Alex asked. I drew the rune sign in the dirt. "It means a cup waiting to be filled," I said. "Or a person who's been hollowed out, waiting for something to make his life meaningful." Alex frowned.
"Gods, that is depressing." "The point is," Blitz said, "I've been considering a Perthrow bag. A bag that can never be filled. The bag would always feel empty and light. Most importantly, it would be any size you wanted."
I looked at Mount Bowling Bag. Its side rose so high that birds wheeled against it in dismay. Or maybe they were just admiring its fine craftsmanship.
"Blitz,"
I said. I like your optimism, but I have to point out that this bag is roughly the size of Nantucket.
Yes, yes, it's not ideal. I was hoping to make a prototype first. But if I can finish the bowling bag by naming it, stitching a little stylish embroidery into the leather, and giving it a command word, I might be able to channel its magic.
He patted his pockets until he found his sewing kit.
I'll need better tools.
Yeah, Alex said. That leather is probably 5 feet thick.
Ah, Bud said, but we have the best sewing needle in the world.
Jack, I guessed. Blitz's eyes sparkled. I hadn't seen him this excited since he created the chainmail cummerbund.
I'll also require some magic ingredients, he said.
You guys will have to pitch in. I'll need to weave thread from special filaments. Something with power, resilience, and magical growth properties. For instance, the hair of a son of Frey. I felt like he'd smacked me in the face with a shoestring.
Say what now?
Alex laughed. I love this plan. His hair needs a good cut. Like, what is this, 1993?
Hold up now, I protested. Also, Blitz scrutinized Alex.
The bag needs to change sizes, which means I'll need to dye the thread with the blood of a shapeshifter.
Alex's smile melted.
How much blood are we talking about?
Just a little.
She hesitated, maybe wondering if she should bust out her garrote and substitute the blood of a dwarf in an inherie. Finally, she sighed and rolled up her flannel sleeve.
All right, dwarf. Let's make a magic bowling bag.
Chapter 37. Meat s'mores roasting on an open fire. Nothing beats camping out in a dreary Jotunheim forest while your friend stitches runes on a giant bowling bag. All day, Alex complained when Blitz estimated his time until completion. Granted, she was a little grumpy after being smacked down by a giant shoelace, getting cut with a knife, and having her blood drained into a thermos cap.
We're on the clock here, dwarf.
I know that. Blitz spoke calmly, like he was addressing a Nidavellir kindergarten class. I also know that we're completely exposed here in the middle of giant territory, and Sam and Hearth are missing, which is killing me. But our best chance of finding them and getting the information we need is by reaching Utgard Loki's palace. The best way to do that without dying is to enchant this bag. So, unless you know a faster way, yes, it will take me all day. I may have to work through the night as well.
Alex scowled, but arguing with Blitzen's logic was as pointless as arguing with his fashion sense.
What are we supposed to do then?
Bring me meals and water, Blitz said. Keep watch, especially at night, so I don't get eaten by trolls. Cross your fingers that Sam and Hearth show up in the meantime. And Magnus, let me borrow your sword.
I summoned Jack, who was happy to help.
Oh, sewing?
His blade runes glowed with excitement.
This reminds me of the great Icelandic Sew-Off of 886 CE. Frey and I destroyed the competition. A lot of warriors went home weeping. We shamed their stitching and darning skills so bad.
I decided not to ask. The less I knew about my father's sewing victories, the better. While Jack and Blitz talked strategy, Alex and I made camp. She'd brought supplies, too, so in no time we had set up a nice level spot with a couple of pup tents and a stone-ringed fire pit.
You must have camped a lot, I noted.
She shrugged, arranging twigs for kindling.
I love the outdoors.
Me and some kids in my pottery studio in Brookline Village, we used to go up to the mountains just to get away. She packed a lot of emotion in those last two words, get away.
A pottery studio, I asked.
She scowled as if trying to detect sarcasm. Maybe she'd field the dumb questions from people like, oh, you make pottery? How cute. I used to like Play-Doh when I was young. The studio was the only consistent place for me, she said. They let me crash there when things were bad at home. From her pack, she dug out a box of wooden matches. Her fingers seemed to fumble when she took a few sticks from the box. The cut on her forehead had turned a darker shade of green, but she still refused to let me heal it.
The thing about clay, she said, it can turn into any shape. I get to decide what's best for each piece. I just sort of listen to what the clay wants. I know that sounds stupid.
You're saying this to a guy with a talking sword. She snorted.
I suppose, but...
The matches fell out of her hand. She sat down hard, her face suddenly chalky.
Whoa!
I scooted over to her.
You're going to have to let me heal that head wound. Gods only know what kind of bacteria was on Tiny's shoestring, and you donating blood to Blitz's arts and crafts project didn't help.
No, I don't want... She faltered.
There's a first aid kit in my bag.
A first aid kit isn't going to do it.
What were you about to say?
Alex touched her forehead and winced.
Nothing.
You said I don't want
this, she snapped. You nosing around in my business. Samira told me that when you heal people, like the elf Hearthstone, you get inside their heads, you see stuff. I don't want that.
I looked away, my hands turning numb. In the fire pit, Alex's kindling pyramid fell apart. Her matches had scattered in a rune-like pattern. But if it meant anything, I couldn't read it. I thought about something Halfborn Gunderson had once told me about wolf packs. Each wolf pushes the limits within its pack. They are constantly testing where they stand in the hierarchy. Where they can sleep, how much they can eat of a fresh kill. They continue to push until the alpha wolf snaps at them and reminds them of their place. I hadn't realized I was pushing, but I'd just gotten a first-rate alpha snapping. I don't really control what happens when I heal. I was surprised that my voice still worked. With Hearth, I had to use a lot of power. He was almost dead. I don't think I could read much from you while just fixing an infected cut. I'll try not to, anyway. But if you don't get some healing... She stared at the bandage on the spot where Blitzen had taken blood from her arm. Yeah, okay. Just forehead only. Nothing inside the head. I touched her brow. She was burning up with fever. I summoned the power of Frey, and Alex let out a gasp. Instantly, her wound closed. Her skin cooled, her color returned to normal. My hands were hardly glowing at all. Something about being out in the wilderness, surrounded by nature, seemed to make the healing easier. I didn't learn a thing, I promised Alex. You are still a mystery, wrapped in a question mark, wrapped in flannel. She exhaled, making a sound between a laugh and a sigh of relief. Thanks, Magnus. Now maybe we can actually get this fire started? She didn't call me Maggie or Beantown. I chose to take that as a peace offering. Once we had a good blaze going, we tried to figure out the best way to repurpose Fadlan's falafel over an open flame. We learned an important lesson. One cannot make s'mores out of lamb meat and chickpea patties. Mostly, we ate the chocolate from Uncle Randolph's house. Blitz took the better part of the morning, spinning his magic thread on his collapsible travel spindle. Of course he had one of those in his kit bag. Why wouldn't he? Meanwhile, Jack flew up and down the side of the bowling bag, perforating the pattern Blitz wanted him to sew. Alex and I kept watch, but nothing much happened. Sam and Hearthstone didn't appear. No giants eclipsed the sun or destroyed the forest with their untied shoelaces. The most dangerous thing we spotted was a red squirrel in a branch above our campfire. It probably wasn't a threat, but since meeting Ratatosk, I took no chances. I kept an eye on it until it leaped to another tree. In the afternoon, things got more exciting. After we fed Blitz some lunch, he and Jack got to work on the actual stitching. Somehow, perhaps with magic? Blitz had made a whole pile of shimmering red yarn from my hair, Alex Fierro's blood, and threads from his own vest. Blitz tied one end of it to Jack's pommel, and Jack flew back and forth across the side of the bag, diving in and out of the leather like a dolphin, leaving a shimmering trail of stitches. Watching him reminded me of how we'd tied up Fenris Wolf, which was a memory I didn't really care to have. Blitzen called out directions. You left, Jack! Drop that stitch! Okay, give me a back stitch! Bunny punched me a hole on the end there! Alex nibbled her chocolate bar. Bunny punch? I have no idea, I admitted. Maybe inspired by the sewing display, Alex unthreaded her garrote from her belt loops. She ran the metal wire across the soles of her boots, scraping off icy mud. Why that weapon? I asked. Or you just tell me to shut up again. Alex gave me a sideways smile. You're fine. It started out as my clay cutter. Clay cutter, like the wire you run through a slab of clay. You figured that out all on your own? Ha ha. I'm guessing most clay cutters don't have combat applications. Not so much. She hesitated. Loki visited me one day at the studio. He was trying to impress me, show me how much he could do for me. He taught me an enchantment I could use to make a magical weapon. I didn't want to give him the satisfaction of helping me. So I tried to spell him the stupidest, most innocuous thing I could think of. I didn't figure a wire with dowel handles could ever be a weapon. And yet. Alex pointed to a nearby boulder, a rough chunk of granite about the size of a piano. She lashed out with her garrote, holding one end like a whip. The wire lengthened as it flew, the far end wrapped around the boulder and held fast. Alex yanked it toward her. The top half of the boulder slid off the bottom half with a grinding sound like a lid being removed from a porcelain cookie jar. The wire flew back to Alex's hand.
Pretty good. I tried not to let my eyes pop out of their sockets, but doesn't make French fries.
Alex muttered something about stupid boys, which I'm sure had nothing to do with me. The afternoon light faded quickly. Over at the bowling bag, Blitz and Jack kept working on their entry in the great Jotunheim sew-off.
The shadows got longer. The temperature plunged. I noticed this because Blitz had recently given me a drastic haircut and my exposed neck was cold. I was just grateful there were no mirrors around to show me the horrors Blitz had worked upon my head.
Alex threw another tree branch into the fire.
You might as well ask.
I stirred.
Sorry?
You want to ask me about Loki? Alex prompted.
Why I put his symbol on my pottery, why I have a tattoo.
You want to know if I'm working for him?
Those questions had been lurking in the back of my mind, but I didn't understand how Alex could know that. I wondered if my healing touch had backfired somehow. Maybe I'd given Alex a look inside my head.
I guess it worries me, I admitted. You act as if you don't like Loki.
I don't.
Then why his symbol?
Alex cupped her hands around the back of her neck.
That design, the two entwined snakes?
It's usually called the Urnis snakes, named after some place in Norway. Anyway, it's not necessarily a symbol of Loki. She laced her fingers and wiggled them around. The snakes signify change and flexibility, being versatile. People started using the snakes to represent Loki, and Loki was fine with that. But I decided, why does Loki get to take over that cool symbol? I like it. I'm making it mine. He doesn't get to own the symbol for change any more than he owns me. To hell him with what people think. I watched the flames break down another piece of wood. A swarm of orange sparks rose from the pit. I remember my dream of Alex's suite, Loki turning into a woman with red hair. I thought about the hesitation in Alex's voice when she talked about Loki as her parent.
You're like the eight-legged horse, I realized.
Alex frowned.
Stanley?
No, the original eight-legged horse. What's his name? Sleipnir.
Mallory Keene told me the story, something about Loki turning into a beautiful mare so he could lure a giant stallion away. And then, Loki got pregnant. She gave birth to Sleipnir.
I glanced at Alex, very aware of the garrote now lying across her thigh.
Loki's not your father, is he?
He's your mom.
Alex just stared at me.
I thought, well, here comes the wire. Goodbye, limbs. Goodbye, head.
She surprised me with a sour laugh.
I think that haircut improved your brain power.
I resisted the urge to pat my hacked locks.
So I'm right?
Yes. She tugged at her glittery pink bootlaces. I wish I could have seen the look on my dad's face when he found out. From what I gather, Loki shapeshifted into the sort of woman my dad liked. My dad was already married, but that never stopped him. He was used to getting what he wanted. He had an affair with this voluptuous redhead. 9 months later, Loki showed up at my dad's doorstep with a little baby as a present. I tried to imagine Loki in his usual dashing form, maybe wearing a green tuxedo, ringing the doorbell of some upscale house in the suburbs.
Hi, I was that lady you had a fling with. Here's our kid.
How did your mortal mom react? I asked. I mean, your dad's wife. I mean, your stepmother.
It's confusing, huh? Alex tossed another stick into the fire. My stepmom wasn't happy about it. I grew up with two parents who resented me and found me embarrassing. Then there was Loki, who kept showing up at random times trying to parent me.
Man, I said.
Woman today, Alex corrected.
No, I mean... I stopped, realizing she was teasing me.
What happened? When did you finally leave home?
2 years ago, more or less.
As for what happened?
A lot.
This time I recognized the warning tone in her voice. I was not welcome to ask for more details.
Still, Alex had become homeless around the same time my mom died, the same time I'd ended up on the streets. That coincidence didn't sit well with me.
Before I could chicken out, I blurted, "Did Loki ask you to come with us?"
She locked eyes with me.
"What do you mean?"
I told her about my dream, her throwing pots at her father, mother, Loki saying, "It's such a simple request."
It was fully dark now, though I wasn't sure when that had happened. In the firelight, Alex's face seemed to shift and jump. I tried to tell myself it wasn't the Loki part of her revealing itself. It was just change, flexibility. Those twisting snakes on her neck were completely innocent.
"You've got it wrong," Alex said.
"He told me not to come." A strange pulsing sound filled in my ears.
I realized it was my own heartbeat. Why would Loki tell you that? And what were you and Sam talking about last night? Some plan? She curled her garrote around her hands. Maybe you'll find out, Magnus. And by the way, if you ever spy on me in your dreams again...
Guys! Blitzen yelled from Mount Bowling Bag. Come take a look!
Chapter 38. You will never, ever guess Blitzen's password. Jack hovered proudly next to his handiwork. Can you have handiwork if you don't have hands? Stitched into the bag's side were several new lines of glowing red runic script. What does it say? Alex asked.
Oh, a few technical runes. Blitz's eyes crinkled with satisfaction. Magic nuts and bolts, terms and conditions, the end user agreement. But there at the bottom it says, Empty leather, a bag completed by Blitzen, son of Freya. Jack helped.
I wrote that, Jack said proudly. I helped.
Good job, buddy, I said. So, does it work?
We're about to find out. Blitzen rubbed his hands eagerly. I'm going to speak the secret word of command. Then this bag will either shrink to an easy carrying size, or... Well, I'm sure it will shrink.
Rewind to the or, Alex said. What else might happen?
Blitzen shrugged. Well, there's a slight chance the bag could expand and cover most of this continent.
No. I'm sure I got it right. Jack was very careful about backstitching the runes where I told him to.
I was supposed to backstitch? Jack glowed yellow. Just kidding. Yeah, I backstitched.
I wasn't feeling so confident. On the other hand, if the bag expanded to continental size, I wouldn't live long enough to care.
Okay, I said. What's the password?
Don't! Blitzen shrieked.
The bowling bag shuddered. The entire forest trembled. The bag collapsed so fast I got nauseated from the change of perspective. The mountain of leather was gone. Sitting at Blitzen's feet was a regular-sized bowling bag.
Yes!
Blitz picked it up and peeked inside. There's a bowling ball inside, but the bag feels completely empty.
Jack, we did it!
They gave each other a high five. Or high just one, since Jack's blade had no fingers.
Hold on, Alex said. I mean, good job and all, but did you seriously make the password...
Password?
Don't!
Blitz threw the bowling bag like a grenade into the woods. Instantly, it grew back to the size of a mountain, causing a tidal wave of crushed trees and terrified animals. I almost felt sorry for the untrustworthy squirrels.
I was in a rush, Blitzen huffed. I can reset the word of command later on, but that would take more thread and more time. For now, can you please avoid saying, you know, that word?
He proceeded to say that word. The bag shrank back to small size. You did great, man, I said. And hey, Jack, nice stitching.
Thanks, senor. I love your sawed-off haircut, too.
You don't look like that Nirvana guy anymore. More like, I don't know, Johnny Rotten? Or a blonde Joan Jett?
Alex cracked up. How do you even know those people? TJ told me you were at the bottom of a river for 1,000 years.
I was, but I've been studying up.
Alex snickered. Joan Jett.
Just shut up, both of you, I grumbled. Who's ready to go bowling? No one was ready to go bowling. Blitzen crawled into a pup tent and collapsed from exhaustion. Then I made the mistake of letting Jack return to pendant form, and I collapsed from exhaustion, feeling like I'd spent all day climbing cliffs. Alex promised to keep watch. At least I think that's what she said. She could have announced, I'll invite Loki into camp and kill you all in your sleep. Ha 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 ha! And I still would have passed out. I dreamed of nothing except dolphins happily leaping through a sea of leather. I woke as the sky was turning from black to charcoal. I insisted Alex get a few hours of shut-eye. By the time all three of us had gotten up, eaten, and broken camp, the sky was a thick blanket of dirty gray. Almost 24 hours lost. Samira and Hearthstone were still missing. I tried to imagine them safe by the fire in Utgard Loki's home, sharing stories and eating well. Instead, I imagined a bunch of giants by the fire, sharing stories about the tasty mortals they'd eaten the night before.
Stop that, I told my brain.
Also, the wedding is tomorrow, said my brain.
Get out of my head!
My brain refused to get out of my head, inconsiderate brain. We hiked through the ravine, trying to keep to the direction Tiny had indicated. You'd think we could have just followed his footprints, but it was difficult to tell them apart from the natural valleys and canyons. After about an hour, we spotted our destination. On a massive cliff in the distance rose a boxy warehouse-type structure. The inflatable Godzilla was gone. The daily rental for something like that must have been exorbitant. But the neon sign still blazed, Utgard Lanes. The letters flashed one at a time, then all together, then with sparkles around the edges. Just so you didn't miss the only neon sign on the biggest cliff in Jotunheim. We trudged up a winding trail that was perfect for colossal donkeys, but not so much for small mortals. The cold wind pushed us around. My feet ached. Thank goodness for Blitzen's magic bowling bag, because dragging the full-size version up that cliff would have been impossible and also not fun. Once we reached the top, I realized just how big Utgard Lanes really was. The building itself could have housed most of downtown Boston. The maroon-upholstered double doors were studded with brass tacks, each as big as your average three-bedroom house. In the grimy windows glowed neon ads for Jotun Juice, Big Small Ale, and Mega Mead. Tethered to posts outside were colossal riding animals, horses, rams, yaks, and yes, donkeys, each roughly the size of Kilimanjaro. "No need to fear," Blitz muttered to himself. "It's just like a dwarven bar, only bigger." "So how do we do this?" Alex asked. "Direct frontal assault?" "Ha ha," I said. "Sam and Hearth might be in there, so we play by the rules. Walk in, ask for guest rights, try to negotiate." "And when that doesn't work," Blitz said, "we improvise." Alex, being all about change and versatility, said, "I hate this idea." Then she frowned at me. "Also, you owe me a drink for dreaming about me." She marched toward the entrance. Blitzen raised his eyebrows. "Do I want to ask?" "No," I said. "You really don't." Getting past the front doors was no problem. We walked right under them without even having to crouch. Inside was the largest, most crowded bowling alley I'd ever seen. To the left, 20 or 30 Statue of Liberty-sized giants lined the bar, sitting on stools that would have made fine high-rise condominiums. The giants were dressed in neon-colored bowling shirts they must have stolen from a disco-era Salvation Army. Around their waists hung an assortment of knives, axes, and spiked clubs. They laughed and insulted each other, and threw back mugs of mead that each could have watered all the crops in California for a year. It seemed a little early in the morning for mead, but for all I knew, these guys have been partying since 1999. That was the song blasting from the overhead speakers, anyway. To our right stood an arcade where more giants played pinball and Ms. Very Large Pac-Man. In the back of the room, about as far away as, oh, Boston is from New Hampshire, still more giants gathered at the bowling lanes in groups of four or five with matching day-glow outfits and suede bowling shoes. A banner across the back wall read, "Utgard Bowling Ultimate Tournament. Welcome, UBUT contestants." One of the giants threw a ball. Thunder boomed as it rolled down the lane. The floor vibrated, shaking me up and down like a wind-up hoppy toy. I scanned the place for Tiny in his gray turkey bowler shirt. I couldn't spot him. Tiny should have been easy to see, but from our vantage point on the floor, there were just too many other enormous obstacles in the way. Then the crowd shifted. Across the room, looking right at me, was a giant I wanted to see even less than Tiny. He sat in a tall leather chair on a dais overlooking the lanes like he was the referee or the MC. His bowling shirt was made of eagle feathers. His slacks were brown polyester. His iron-shod boots looked like they'd been made from recycled World War II destroyers. Clasped around his forearm was a Thane's gold ring studded with bloodstones. His face was angular and handsome in a cruel sort of way. Straight, coal-black hair swept his shoulders. His eyes glittered with amusement and malice. He definitely would have made the list for 10 most attractive murderers of Jotunheim. He was about 90 feet taller than the last time I'd seen him, but I recognized him. "Big boy," I said. I'm not sure how he heard my pipsqueak voice through all the chaos, but he nodded in acknowledgement.
"Magnus Chase," he called out. "So glad you could make it."
The music died. At the bar, giants turned to look at us. Big Boy raised his fist as if offering me a microphone. Clasped in his fingers, like G.I. Joe figures, were Samira and Hearthstone. Chapter 39. Elvis Has Left the Bowling Bag. "We claim guest rights," I yelled. "Utgard Loki, let our friends go." I thought that was pretty brave of me, considering we were facing a heavily armed, badly dressed Statue of Liberty convention. The assembled giants laughed. At the bar, one yelled,
"What did you say? Speak up!"
I said... The bartender turned 1999 back on and drowned me out. The giants howled with glee. I frowned at Blitzen. You told me Taylor Swift songs were dwarf music. Does this mean that Prince was a giant?
Huh?
Blitzen kept his eyes locked on Hearthstone, who was still trapped and struggling in Utgard Loki's fist.
No, kid. This just means that giants have good taste in music. You think Jack could cut our friends out of the giant's hand?
Before Utgard Loki crushes them?
Unlikely.
Alex wrapped her garrote around her hand, though I didn't see what good it would do unless she intended to give the giants a good flossing.